Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we'll have the honor of two wonderful, amazing guests. We have the Chief Rabbi of South Africa, and we have he'll be speaking about Shabbos around the world, his project. I think he had 80-some-odd countries involved, including my wonderful daughter and granddaughter who live in Eretz Yisrael, and Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, the Goyen from Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan, who'll be speaking about modern fertility issues, freezing ova, etc. You're listening to us, Matzah Shabbos, 11 to 12 midnight on WMCA 570 AM or 570.com or the Nachum Siegel Network. You can listen to us Monday, 11 AM at Nachum Siegel. You can listen to us anytime on our podcast, headlinesbook.com, under the podcast section. Or you can listen to us through our hotline, 732-806-8700. Before we get into, I'd like to start with, we had a caller. You know, we get many callers and many emails, and I like to take the one that disagrees the most and put that on the air, because you learn much more from your dissenters. If you have a 99-to-1 positive vote, you're going to learn more from that number one who dissented than from the 99 who agreed. So let's go to a gentleman. He seems to be a Talmud Chacham. Let's hear what he has to say and allow me to respond.
Regarding your last Matzah Shabbos show, you said that Yitzchak loved Esav, without regard to his riches. The Drasha Saran says that Ein Safik, that Yitzchak did not know about the riches of Esav. Much more than had he known, he would not have loved them. Also, the Pharish Pasuk, Mishlei Chosech Shivtai Soinei Benoi, which Rashi explains that if you don't give your child Musar, it will lead him to go to Tarvis Ra, and the Melee will hate him. I mean, that's a normal reaction to a child being in Tarvis Ra is to hate him. We hate people who are the enemies of Hashem. Also, we find that there's a mitzvah, according to Hagolis Maimoni, there's a mitzvah to hate Russia. That would apply to one's own son also. There's no mass upon him whatsoever. So, also, you left out part of the pasuk. You said, Yitzchak is Esav. Yitzchak loved Esav. He just forgot to finish the pasuk. He tied the fifth. Either it means that he tricked him, they think Kate had master and Samelach, needing Yitzchak to believe that he was a tzaddik and a daktik, or because he gave him food. So it clouded his Abba Mikhalkalas Ashurim, since he had Megias, because he fed him. But in any case, it's not so simple just to love Rishon. So I think you shouldn't just spout modern thinking, forward thinking, without any basis whatsoever. Check up the facts and then say things. Thank you so much, Colton. Regarding the quote unquote the mitzvah that the father loves the son no matter what. I just saw a Lashon Rambam, a famous Rambam. I'm surprised you missed it. Perek Aleph Mehilchos Avol Halacha Yud. Kol HaParshin Midarkei Tzibur. V'heim ha'noshim sheparku oil ha'mitzvahs me'al tzavoran. They threw off the yoke of mitzvahs. V'heim ha'nechlolim b'chval Yisrael. Tasiyas ha'mitzvahs. V'kivet ha'moyadois. V'yishivas batek netiyas abotim midrashos. They don't join the rest of Chval Yisrael with doing mitzvahs and moyadois and sitting in b'shul and b'smedrash. El ha'rehen k'v'nei chayrin la'atzman. They're otherwise known as fry and off the derech. They're free. Bishar u'mois. Kain haminim b'hamshemodim ha'moisrim. Kol eilu ein mis'ablan aleihem. Ela acheihem bishar kreveihem. The relatives. Very close relatives. The mother, the father, the brothers, the sisters, all the relatives. Loivshim levonim. Mis'atzim levonim. They wear fancy, nice clothing. V'oichlim b'shoisim usmeichim. They eat and drink and make merry. Why? Sha'avdu sign of Shalakadish Baruch Hu. Because the enemy of Hashem is lost. Malayim HaKosav Oymer Halayim Mitzanecha Hashem Esna. We have a Beferish Rambam who, without mincing words, calls a person like that an enemy of Hashem, and he's an enemy of the family also. There's no father, there's no mother, there's no relation, there's no relative, no nothing, and it's a simcha that he's gone. So to say otherwise is Megala Panam B'Torah Shalei Kalocha. You make nice speeches, but you have to say the truth. Kol Tov V'Matzliach.
What this Talmud Chacham said, because I think it's important. Do we or don't we hate a son who's a Rasha? So his first point was from in Mishlein. He says, Rashi says, if you spear the rod and your child turns into a Rasha, you will hate him. Rashi's not saying it's a mitzvah to hate him. Rashi's predicting that most people who have a son who doesn't conform with their wishes in the worst imaginable way, yes, the parents do hate them. That is the reality. In fact, if you look at the other Mefarshim, like the Ralbag or the Matsudis, they say, Chayshir Shiftei Asayin Ebedet. A different shot. They say, if you spear the rod, that's a sign that you dislike your child. Doesn't mean you, most people who don't want to hit their child, oh, I love him so much, let's not do it. Ralbag and Matsudis say, no, if you spear the rod, it means you're not doing your child a favor. Like it says, for example, and here I'm ad-libbing, it says, let's say, by David and both Adoniah and Avshalom, it says, V'loy atzavay aviv. His father never said no to him. That's not a healthy thing. We all agree to that. The question is, what happens when a son, Chas V'Shalom, does become Rasha? Should the father hate him? Rashi doesn't address that. Now, and then he brought the Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchos Avelos, it's also Paskin and Shulchan Aruch and Shin Mem Hei Hei, and we know the Jaredeya, that says that when a person dies and he was a Rasha, so the halacha is Ba'avoid Rishoyim Rina, there's joy. The question is, does that apply to a parent? So he asked that as a question. You see that there's a mitzvah, Ba'avoid Rishoyim Rina. So first of all, assuming, even taking that halacha on face, prima facie, it says that after his death, it's Bavoid Rishayim Rina. We're talking about while he's alive, not while he's dead. And our point was is that a father's love is the only hope for a child, so a father is always mechuyev to love his child. And additionally, I'll just mention that the Shulchan Aruch says, Acheyem v'shar krevim. It does not say the parents. So even I don't think this is relevant because we're saying it's after Misa, but even if you want to say it does mean, it could be that a parent is different, and I'll bring you a few proofs. Proof number one is, by Chushim ben Dan, it says that he knocked off the head of Esav, and Chazal say, the Medrash Rabbah says, it rolled in Kivrei Shal Yitzchak, and the head of Esav is buried in the Ma'aretz Achpela, Becheikai Shal Yitzchak, in the lap of Yitzchak. Now, if we want to go back to the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Mem Hei, in Shin Samach Bei says, that Ein Kovrim Rasha Eitzal Tzadik. How could Esav be buried in the lap of Yitzchak? Well, is it possible that a parent is different? Another raya I'll bring you. It says that even though a parent, even though halacha is you don't sit avelus on a Rasha because we don't love the Rasha, the Torah brings that Rabbeinu Gershon sat Shiva for his son, even though when he converted. So we see even though his son was a Rasha and he has a din of Mishumadim that you don't, the father did sit Shiva. That's another raya. But let me bring you another one. I have many rayas. It says by Avram, Kachna es bincha es yechidcha asher ahavta. So Rashi on the spot says, es bincha yechidcha. He said, I have sons. He said, no, ki b'yitzchak yikar l'chazar. He said, asher ahavta. Avram said, I love Yishmael too. Now this is talking about after Yishmael is a Rasha, after he was chased from the house, what does Avram say on him? Asher ahavta. I'm his father, and I love him. Now, this Chasheva Yid who left a message also said, he said, you didn't say Ki Tzayid Befiv. Vayev Yitzchak Esav Ki Tzayid Befiv. Well, Tzayid Befiv, I didn't say it, because many Mefarshim struggle with it. And they say Ki Tzayid Befiv. He asked them all these foolish questions. How could Yitzchak be fooled by all these foolish questions? So if you look in the Medrash, the Medrash actually asks this question, and there are many Pirushim in the Medrash, right? But for starters, just, you know, go to the Achrayim. The verse that I said is not mine. It's the Chedusha. If you look in the Chedusha Melatayra, he says, what's the Kitzayid Besiv? He says it's because Yitzchak, Esav gave Yitzchak an answer. At the end of time, when they say, Banecha Chatu, he'll be able to say, what about my son? I loved my son. So the Chedusha Rim says this very exact verse. He says, Kitzayid Besiv is, it gave Yitzchak an out. But even if you don't believe it, if you look in the Medrash HaGadol on the spot here, it says, well, how could he hate him? He's a Rasha. He says, Kol min oyhev es minay. A min loves his min. A father loves his child. But there are many Chazals here on the spot. So I know he brought a Drasha Saran that said he did. If he would have known he's a Rasha, well, let me ask a few questions. Well, you'll see many Midrashim arguing this. But for the starters, doesn't it say, the eyes of Yitzchak had weakened from the smoke of incense of the daughters of the wives of Esav who were being makriv to Avodah Zarah. Seems he did know at that point. And if you look here in the Bereishis Rabbah, what does it say? His eyes got weakened. He looked at Esav HaRasha, and Hashem said, it's enough. I don't want you to see anymore. So we have many Midrashim that don't agree with the Ran, as well as the psukim seem, that would seem Ashmayis psukim, that say Yitzchak did know he was a Rasha. So the question then, why does he love him? They go back to him because Oyhev es Mina, your father loves his son. We see that from where? We see that from both, from Yaakov, Avram loved Esav, loved Yishmael, Yitzchak loved Esav. Esav's head is buried in the lap of Esav, even though of the lack of Yitzchak, even though there's a rule, Ein Kaivrin Sadek Yitzchak Rasha. Because to a father, a son should always be right. A father should always champion his son. So I very much appreciate this very, thoughtful comment. And at the very least, I would say, certainly b'chayi of the son. Maybe lach ha'maisa is different. Let me go to another point in this week's parsha that I think is important. You know, we've all heard so many marriage jokes since, very often we're entertained at a Sheva Brachas with somebody who thinks it's funny to make marriage jokes. Look at this week's Parsha. We have Rachel and Leah. And what do we know? We know that V'yehev Yaakov is Rachel. Yaakov loved Rachel, right? And what do we know about his relationship with Leah? Well, let's look. It says, V'tikra Shmai Ruvain ki ra Hashem ba'ani. God saw my pain. Shimon, Kishama Hashem Kisnua Anechi. Leah wasn't very well beloved, it would seem. Right? There's a Tosfos Riazakin that says, it's the Balia Tosfos. It says on the Pasuk, Kiel Ish Shnei Nashim, Hachas Ahuva V'Achas Snua, Leah Ben Habchor Lasnua. So the Pirsha Tosfos Alatari says, talking about Rachel and Leah. One wasn't liked. Ultimately, though, Leah is the Eim HaBanim. She has most of the children. What is the Torah telling us here? Now, of course, it's hard for us to try to divine maybe even one drop out of a million of what the Kavan of the Torah is, but think of it. I may have said this before, but I'll say it again. Because the Gemara at the end of Tainus, it says, the Mishnah at the end of Tainus says that there were two Yom Tovim in Klal Yisrael, where the girls would come out looking for a shidduch. And what would it say? I would say the beautiful girls would say, marry me, I'm beautiful. The wealthy girls would say, and money? Marry me for money. The miuchases would say, for children. And it would say, those that had none of the above would say, marry me, l'shem shamayim. Now, when you learn that Gemara, you shake your heads and you say, wow, what a funny thing to say. It's like, marry me, you won the booby prize. I have nothing. No looks, no money, no mishpacha, no yichis. But maybe they're saying something deeper. You know, we're all sparkly when we're engaged and young. We're at the skinniest of our life. I can't say if everybody, certainly for me, right? Our wives are the youngest they're ever going to be, that's for sure. We're the youngest we're ever going to be. Probably have more kaya than we ever had. Now, what happens if that beautiful, handsome, young fillin, chassan and kala, one day he doesn't look so good? Maybe with beauty, he lost the beauty. Well, maybe he or she, maybe their job isn't going so well. Maybe the boy lost his job, right? What about, well, yiches, it's hard to do. Family, you know, sometimes families, parents get divorced afterwards. They have other issues. So imagine if the only reason the girl loves you is because of some reason. You were handsome, you were rich, you were, you know, miyuches, you had a wonderful family. Does that mean if I lose my job, I'm done? Does that mean if I put on a few weight, a little weight, or maybe my hair falls out, you know, that happens? Does that mean that's it, we're done? That seems a little shallow. So the Gaon says like this. He says, Yaakov loves Rachel. He says, Yaakov wanted that the whole Mahalach of Klal Yisrael with Kaviyachel should be beautiful. Klal Yisrael should be beautiful. Klal Yisrael should be perfect. What do we know about Rachel? Rachel was beautiful. Rachel haisi yifas tayar yifas mara, inside and outside. And look at her children. The children is Yosef. Is Yosef bonei sadeh salei shur? Yosef was so beautiful. That's what Yaakov wanted. And what did the Rabbeinu Shalom say? Really? What happens if things don't work out so well? Let's say you stumble. Let's say Klal Yisrael makes mistakes. What do we know about Bnei Yosef? It says, Shol achas v'olfi. Rachel stands for perfection. One mistake, Yadon. David, it says, Shtayim v'loy al-salah. He made many mistakes. Because what does Leah stand for? Rachel means an ooh. It's a lamb. It's white. It's frisky. You ever see lambs? They're so lovable. They're so, nobody could dislike a lamb. What does Leah stand for? Leah stands for Nil AC means I was exhausted. I struggled. Things didn't come easy to me. So when we're young, we all want to marry Rachel. But when we get a little older, we say, you know, maybe I would have been better off marrying Leah, the one who understands struggling, the one who understands setback, the one who understands darkness, not so sparkly, but somebody who could help me through the dings, the bruises of life. There's Rachel and there's Leah. Rachel was so beautiful. Perfect, inside, outside. Leah, ding, but oh so wise. She could understand darkness. It says that the daughter of Leah, Dinah, Yaakov was Nenash. She should have married Esav. She should have married Esav. But once, must be that Dinah could have fixed Esav too. Leah was so wise, she could have fixed Esav. Don't we need a wife that understands the bruises of life? So now let's go back to the Gemara. It says, the beauty said, marry me because I'm beautiful. The smart one said, because I'm smart. I'm rich. I'm famous. The last one says, because I'm a yuchas, a famous family. And what did the other one say? No. Not a good idea. None of the above. Marry me for the right reason. Marry me because there's real love between us. Because, you know, I promise you, one day, there are going to be days when you wake up in the morning and it's all not so good. Marry me for the real reason, because we love each other. We see past exogenous exterior things. We all want to marry Rachel, the Torah tells us. What does Hashem say? Hashem says, no. You want to marry Rachel, you really need a Leah. If you want to have a real marriage that can withstand turbulence, troubles, the winds of time, you're better off marrying a Leah. That's the marriage that really lasts. Let's go to our wonderful guests. And by the way, I invite you all to send an email. Blineda, every week or two, I'll pick the one that really stands out and read it and either agree or disagree. And I allow you, my wonderful audience, to decide, do you agree with me or maybe you agree with the writer or the speaker. Let's go to the line. We have on the phone with us, from South Africa, the Chief Rabbi of South Africa, Rabbi Warren Goldstein. Welcome, Rabbi Goldstein.
Yeah, it's great to speak to you and to your listeners.
Now, Rabbi Goldstein, just for the record, I'd like you to know that you're the second Chief Rabbi of South Africa we've had on the program, because we've previously really? Had the honor of having Rabbi Moshe Sternbach on the program.
That's so, wonderful.
So if that sets a precedent, it means your next shtetl will be Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem. So you've had a wonderful project that has made worldwide, you know, acclaim. I understand it's in over 200 cities. It's in 30-some-odd countries called the Shabbos Project. Can you tell us in America, our listenership, what the Shabbos Project is and what inspired you to do it?
Well, the Shabbos Project began in South Africa in 2013. It was a call that I made to the Jewish community of South Africa to keep one Shabbos together. The people who otherwise would not normally keep Shabbos to set aside, it was Pashas Lech Lecha, and we asked everyone to come together in a spirit of unity to keep that one Shabbos. And it was an amazing, amazing response from the community. People really were inspired and uplifted by it, and there was such an outpouring that came from it that people around the world started taking note, and we actually created a YouTube video to explain what had happened in South Africa, and then for 2014 invited Jews around the world to participate in that year's Shabbos Project. And already in 2014, you know, emails started pouring in from all around the world, and there were soon Shabbos Project activities for that year in more than in 465 cities around the world already in 2014. And it really covered so many different countries, and people got really involved. In 2015, it spread. In 2015, we were dealing with more than 5,000 partners around the world. It reached 919 cities in 2015, and it really touched all over Eretz Israel and America. And then, actually, in 2016, the project grew even further to 1,152 cities, dealing with 6,000 partners around the world. It was in more than 160 towns and cities across Eretz Israel. And in the United States, well over 450 towns and cities. There were strong Shabbos Project activities throughout the United States and throughout North America, in Atlanta and in Cleveland and in Miami and in Toronto, and right across the length and breadth of North America, there was a very high level of participation. And I think that people have really been touched by the fact that Shabbos is such a special mitzvah, and it has so much to offer. It's such an inspiring mitzvah, particularly in today's times when people are looking for opportunities to connect with one another and with their families and to connect with Hashem. And I think that people can truly appreciate why the Gemara, this is the one mitzvah that the Gemara calls a matana, a true gift from Hashem.
So, Rabbi Goldstein, two questions. How many countries were you in this year?
So it was in 94 countries in 1,152 cities, and it mamash went everywhere. I even got an email from a Jew, Faisal Benkalt, who lives in Karachi in Pakistan. He heard about the project on Twitter, and he decided to keep Shabbos there in the middle of Pakistan. And that's just one example, but it mamash touched so many different people. It was particularly strong this year in France, and there was a wonderful project in Nice, you know, which had seen that terrible terrorist attack, and yet, you know, people came out in big numbers fearlessly, you know, to associate with Am Yisrael and to associate with Shabbos. And Eretz Yisrael, there was more than 30 major events that happened across Tel Aviv. There were major events that happened in Ashkelon and Ashdod and Lod, and from Eilat to Tzfat, and right across the length and breadth of the country. Even the Israeli Defense Forces entered into the project. They sent out a special message to all of their base commanders to talk to their soldiers about the Shabbos Project and the importance of Shabbos and the importance of Jewish unity. And so even they participated. And so there's so many inspiring stories that have come from across Eretz Yisrael, from across the world, where people really connect with us on a very deep level, because I think there's a thirst for Shabbos in the world, and there's also a thirst for true Jewish unity, where Jews can connect with one another in the deepest and most meaningful way, in a way that helps to transcend all of the machlokes that sometimes divides us.
So, Rabbi Goldstein, I guess the goal should be to get to Kuf Chav Zayin Medinas, like Esther, right? That would be ultimately the goal.
Yes.
So, Rabbi Goldstein, my daughter and granddaughter, who live in Eretz Yisrael, they in Talbiya, they actually went to a challah bake-a-thon, and my son-in-law hosted. I think there were hundreds of people, and he has a community kollel in Eretz Yisrael that came. What inspired you? This is It's like sort of like the Daf Yomi. Did you wake up one morning? Like, where did this come from?
You know, it came from a realization when I was looking at my kehillah, thinking that Shabbos is so important. If we want to take the kehillah to the next level, Shabbos is so important. And then trying to think, how do we make it something real and tangible that people can do, but also something authentic? And I think this has been an important element of the project, is that, you know, it's about educating and sharing with people the beauty of Shabbos as a total immersive experience. And you can't believe how many emails and letters I've received from people who experienced their very first Shabbos in their life and what they did. I've received an email from a woman in Scottsdale, Arizona, Lana Wilder, who went to the Chalabet in Scottsdale for the first time in 2014. She was so moved by that experience that she decided to keep Shabbos with her husband, Chris, who was not Jewish at the time, and they kept Shabbos since then, and he entered into a Geirus program, which has just gone through in the last week or two. His full Geirus just went through, and so the amazing, you know, one can never underestimate the power of Shabbos to change Kalisol, and I think that's part of the depth of what Chazal was sharing when they said that Ilmala Yisrael Misam Shtei Shabbosos Miyada Yunigalim. So firstly, the Bavli says Shtei Shabbosos, two Shabbosos, that when people, if the Kalisol keep two Shabbos, they'd be immediately redeemed, and the Yerushalmi says one Shabbos. But I think the Amkris of Pshat, the depth of the explanation of what the Shas is telling us, is something. It's not telling us like a trick on how to bring Mashiach, because there's a very powerful article by Rav Yosef Yehuda Leib Bloch, tells the Rosh Hashiva in Shirei Das, where he explains that, you know, we can't get involved in how to bring Mashiach or how not to. That's not our ASIC, that belongs to Hashem. So I think what Chazal are teaching us here is that Shabbos has the Koach HaGeula. It has the real power to redeem, and redemption is transformation. So, you know, Shabbos has a tremendous power to change the world, and that's really, you know, the vision behind it, to say how can we change the Jewish world in the most profound way, and Shabbos is the most powerful vehicle to do that.
So, Rabbi Goldstein, let me go to a little bit of a greater issue, and then I'll ask you a few halachic questions about Shabbos and with the Shabbos, you know, the Shabbos-thon. How is it that in the United States, we're so vociferous as a community? We have the Orthodox, the Reform, the Conservative, the Reconstructionist. We have the Modern Orthodox. We have the Hasidim, the Haredim, the Litvisha, the Ashkenazim, the Sephardim. And we could go on and on and on. And yet in South Africa, somehow, astonishingly, I'm going to say the words, you all get along. And it's such an incredible model if we could take something from it, the concept of achdus, of arvus, you know, kigavna deinu mesyachtun li'elo b'yechad, aifachi yishadul sata b'raza de'echad. How do you get along, b'raza de'echad? What is the secret of South Africa?
I think a very important secret in Jewish unity is true respect for one another. And that is, you know, to see that every Jew is precious in the eyes of Hashem, and to truly respect every Jew, and also to believe that the Torah belongs to every Jew. It doesn't it doesn't belong to one camp or another camp. It belongs mamish to the entire Klal Yisrael, and I think that's, you know, that's very important. It's something that is possible. I think that, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, it's something that we have in South Africa. We have one base in one Kashrus Heksha. It's really an integrated community, and that's something which is so very, very precious. The Shabbos Project has shown that vision of unity is possible around the world as well, because it's amazing, you know, how people have come together from all different parts of the community, to make the Shabbos Project. You know, just in Baltimore, the Shabbos Project committee that is in Baltimore, Robertson Weisbrod sits on that committee together with members of all different streams of Jewish communities in Baltimore, and people come together truly in a spirit of unity to make it happen. And I think that it shows that it is possible, and we need to strive for it, because when there's Achdus in Klal Yisrael, then so many so many other things are possible. And I think that Shabbos is a way of actually creating that Achdus because it's so powerful, and it does come from the Kerech Achdus. Shabbos is a Kerech as a Ma'ached in the world, as a unifying force in the world, and holding all of the Bria together, all of creation together, but it also can certainly hold all of Klal Yisrael together.
Now, here in America this week, I had the honor of going for the first time in my life to the Kinnus HaShluchim, where there were some 5,000 or 6,000 people, including some 3,500 Shluchim from all around the world. And as it started, people were mingling. I spoke to, there was a fellow next to me. I said, "Where are you from?" I said to him, he said, "I'm from Siberia, a town called Ofa." He said, "And when I left 2 days ago, it was 26 below zero." And I looked at him. He said, "Yes, I grew up and, you know, locally, and, you know, and I met a shliach from Patagonia who said his wife has to drive 9 hours to go to the mikveh." Truly astonishing people. So my question to you is, as the chief rabbi of a country that where people do get along, do you think that we as Orthodox are fulfilling our obligation to the 80 or 90% of the Jews of the world who are really, you know, the Nidchei Yisrael? Are we doing an adequate job of it or not?
I think that there's a tremendous achrayus on every single one of us to talk to as many Jews as possible, and to reach out to as many Jews as possible, and that applies to every Jew in the world has that achrayus, and I think that's an important part of the mindset, is that we view every Jew as equal and as having an equal connection to Torah, and we talk as equals, not in any way which is condescending, but as complete equals. And that's such an important part of how the discourse needs to take place. And I'll just give you an example in the context of the Shabbos Project. The very important element has been on social media. And the Facebook campaign spoke to more than, 10 million people around the world, unique individuals around the world. And in Eretz Yisrael, alone, 3.5 million people. So we're talking to millions and millions and millions of Jews about the concept of Shabbos. And today, it's actually possible to talk to so many millions of people because of the technologies. And obviously, these technologies, have the potential for harm. But if they can be harnessed for mitzvahs, there's a koach, there's a tremendous force within it. That allows it to reach and to touch every person, to touch every Jew, and especially when we come with an authentic message of true Shabbos and of Kedusha, it's a message which resonates with every Jew, no matter where they are in the world and who they are. I had a very interesting experience on the radio, internet television. I was interviewed on Ynet, which is one of the big news internet sites in Eretz Israel, together with Shlomi Shabbat, who's one of their top singers in Israel. He was going to play at the Havdalah concert in Paris. And I had the most amazing experience with him because he was talking about how, even though he's not known as a Dati person, how much he treasures what Shabbos is. And then the interviewer said to him, "So do you play on the Shabbos? Do you perform?" And I was concerned that, I didn't know what he was going to answer, because he'd have to be truthful on such a question, which is so public. And he said he refuses to play on the Shabbos. He won't. And that just to me was just an important reminder of where Am Yisrael is. And then when you say the word Shabbos to a Jew, that touches their neshama in the most powerful and profound way. And we need to be optimists and have emunah, not just emunah in Hashem, of course emunah in Hashem, but emunah in His Torah, to faith in Hashem's Torah to change the world, and then faith in Klal Yisrael. And that's, remember what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe Rabbeinu, is that maminim b'nei maminim. You don't never underestimate the koach of Am Yisrael, and to reach Am Yisrael, and it's with that kind of optimism that is so vital, as we plot the way forward for a vibrant Jewish future.
So, Rabbi Goldstein, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you a few halacha shailas, because we are a halacha program. When you invite guests for Shabbos, and I'm not just talking about the Shabbos program, I'm talking about in general, or you invite, and they're secular, they're, for the most part, tenik shenishbas, I mean, I would, you know, Ramesh certainly held, you know, many great Paiskim today held there with Tenek Shenishbas, including the Chazenish, the great Machmir. So we have a problem. You know, there's a Gemara in Chulin, it's, I think, like Dafkov Zion, that says you're not supposed to give food to somebody who won't wash his hands because of Lifnei Iver. And Rabbeinu Yoina extends that to say, or somebody who won't make a bracha, even if it's not a hamotzi, but it's a fruit, he says, if they won't make a bracha, and you're not allowed to. And the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchas Brachas, it's, I don't know, Kuf Samach Dalet or Kuf Samach Gimel in that area. Paskin's the way that there's an Isser of Lifnei Iver. So how did you, as the founder of the Shabbos Project, knowing that so many, you know, multitudes, Mamish Rivavais Yisrael, you know, joyously will celebrate the Shabbos Project, how did you deal with the concept of Lifnei Iver?
Yeah, also, you know, what I do a lot with you know, in the project, in order to make sure that everything is done right, you know, so after the serious challenges, we've got a base in here. I discuss with my dayanim, talk through shailas. Also, you know, talk often. And I'm not implying that anyone is. I don't want to say that any one particular person has taken us right for all of it. But I talk often to Rav Osher Weiss, Shlita. Also, you know, also speak to Rav Yitzchak Berkovitz Shlita and. And
by the way, both Rabbi Goldstein, both have been here on the program.
Yeah, so
Rabbi Osher Weiss, we've had on two or three times, and Rabbi Berkowitz two times. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've discussed many aspects, you know, different shailas with them. Also, from time to time, you know, I speak to Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky Shlita to discuss different aspects of the project. I'm not saying one particular person has taken an achrayus for every aspect of it, but you know, I think a very important part is consulting, and I think there's also, you know, it's about the importance of being able to talk to all of Klal Yisrael. You know, Rav Shlomo Zalman, you know, spoke about broadening the concept of Lifnei Iver. That, you know, that it's very important to realize that if you're reaching out to a person, that there's not a Lifnei Iver in that. If you're actually reaching out to a person, so there's many poskim to rely on. And I think, you know, there's such an imperative now in the days and times that we live to reach out to as many Jews as possible, because, you know, we have to share Torah with as many people as possible.
And I think the Rav Shlomo Zalman that you're referring to says that, he says, ultimately the concept of Lifnei Iver means, just translated, do not place a stumbling block in front of a blind person. He says, how could it be a stumbling block, even if they are over an Averu, where ultimately your goal is to bring them closer? And Ramesh Sternbach has a tshuva, the prior rabbi of South Africa, your predecessor, says the same idea. He says, would you say a surgeon who operates on somebody is damaging the person or helping the person? He said, sometimes to make a person better, they have to go through, you know, they have to go through medicine, they need a shot, etc. He says, that would not be considered a chavala. He said, neither in this case would it be considered a stumbling block. So it's based on your predecessor's psak that you're being simach,
well,
I say.
Well, just as a point of clarity, just in terms of the structure of how the kehillah works here, we have an office of the chief rabbi, and then we have an office of the Rosh Beis Din and Dayanim. And so we have different departments. When Rav Moshe Sternbach lived in South Africa, he didn't hold an official position in South Africa. He paskened for many people, and obviously it was a great Talmid Chacham to have him around. It was a tremendous chutz for the tzibur. But he didn't actually hold an official position within the tzibur. Just as a point of clarity. But of course, you know, he has many talmidim here, and his hashpah was tremendous, and was a great chutz to have him around.
Now, what do you do when people say, oh, I'd love to come to the Shabbos Project, I'm going to load all my children into the van on Shabbos morning and come? What do you respond to them?
You know, the Shabbos Project puts out a message which is explaining to people how to keep Shabbos for the first time and what's happening. And we put out a lot of detailed material for people how to keep Shabbos. And it's... It's been, and then we, you know, people make their own decisions. They make their own decisions, and that's the beauty of it. It's not, we put out the material, we put out the chinuch, and we leave it out there, and people make their own decisions. And you know, many people, you know, there's so many people who are keeping Shabbos for the first time, and then other people for whom it's more of a journey. And then one year they may not, but the next year they may do that as well. But we don't get into the position of saying to a person, this is what you must do, this is what you mustn't do. It's a chinuch project, and we share that as widely and openly as possible, and then and encourage people to do as much as possible, and then people make their own decisions.
Now, Rabbi Goldstein, I may be going a little bit off target here, but I'd like to ask you the question anyway. You know, years ago, both Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik said, we should not go into conservative or reform shuls to teach, to speak, etc. Do you think that given the fact that both conservative and reform have, to a great extent, I mean, they're dissipating, they're crumbling, and whereas orthodoxy, I mean, I always like to say that my father said when he there were two yeshivas in America when he was growing up. Today there are, I spoke to Rabbi Tzvi Blum just yesterday, he said there's $3 billion spent a year in education. He said there are 300,000 children, can I know her, in America in the orthodox system. It's a tenth of that in the reform. Do you think maybe the times are changed and we have become a fortress, and our chiyuv to our brethren to be makariv is to say, let's go into their schools and let's go into their shuls and explain to them why they're collapsing and why ultimately children recognize when there are, you know, steerous paradoxes in their ideology and where they preach one thing and do another thing? Do you think maybe the times are changing?
Look,
I mean, you have the chief rabbi of the conservative movement in California. One of their great, you know, leaders is this fellow David Wolpe, I will not call him rabbi, who now announced that he will be performing gay marriages. This is a conservative rabbi. So they've totally left the fold. Has it become the point where we're not threatened by them anymore? There's nothing there. It's an empty shell. Should we be going into their shuls? Should we be teaching? Should we be reaching out to them before they just are so lost that there's nothing left to bring back?
Look, a very important ethos of the Shabbos Project, and I can only talk from my experiences within the Shabbos Project, because those are the experiences that I know, and I can just talk from that experience. It's in the Shabbos Project, we never talk about different categories of Jews. We just talk about Jews, and we try to avoid the labels, and we try to avoid speaking about us and them, because we're all part of Klal Yisrael, and we just try and talk to as many people as possible without getting into labels of who's what, and just sharing authentic Torah with as many people as possible. And that's the derech that we, you know, follow in the Shabbos Project, and it's the experience that I can talk from, and I feel very strongly around that ethos, and that's a very crucial part of the Shabbos Project.
So the Shabbos Project is based on love and on respect. That's right.
And
Zachar and Shamar. Zachar is love and Shamar is respect.
Yeah, and moving beyond labels and just sharing Torah with as many people as possible.
Thank you very much. That is the Chief Rabbi of South Africa, Rabbi Warren Goldstein. It's been an honor to have you on with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. We have the honor of having with us Hagoyin Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, Rosh Yeshiva in Rabbi Yitzhak Elchanan. He's a musmach of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Mendel Zaks, a Talmud of Rabbi Elia Chazan. He's a mechaber of so many svarim, too numerous to actually say here on the air. And he has the unique honor, I believe I saw this once, in one of the Igros Moshe's tshuvas, he calls to him Yedidi, or of Yehuda David Bleich, and I know nobody else that I personally know of alive today who Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has given the honor of Yedidi. It's a great honor to have you with us, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you very much.
Rabbi Bleich, so you're one of the world's most foremost halachic experts in fertility. Could you share with us some of the fertility questions that come your way? The world has changed so much in the last 30 years, 40 years. many new processes, and it continues to change daily. Can you share with us some of the shyness that come your way as the world authority in this?
I'm not sure that I'm an expert in anything, but I'm a Talmid, and I have investigated some of the fertility issues as well as the shyness in halacha. Many of the shyness that are presented are in the field of assisted procreation, people who can't have children in the normal way, and there are ways and means of increasing fertility. Depends whether the problem is with the female or with the male in terms of the woman, if it's a matter of ovulation. So there are ways to use hormone treatments. Those generally involve Shabbos shilas. Can you do these procedures on Shabbos? Can you not do these procedures on Shabbos? Whether insemination can take place during the period of Zayin Nikim, et cetera, et cetera. But the really serious shilas arise with regard to male infertility. The questions begin with the diagnosis of male infertility, which requires examination of the semen. Male infertility is the result either of total absence of sperm in the semen or what they call moderate male infertility. Instead of having a normal complement of sperm, which is anything from 120 to 150 million per cc, it goes all the way down to 50 to 80 is considered moderate. Below 20 is considered absolutely infertile. The way that you treat that is primarily by combining ejaculates, so you get a higher concentration. Those present very serious shyness, both in terms of the diagnosis, and I'm not going to enter into how that can be done with avoiding the shyness. Needs the cooperation of a fertility specialist. And then the issue with regard to combination involves ejaculation, and the problem is how to obtain the zera, the semen, without being in violation of the prohibition against zera levatola. Those are questions that I don't think we're going to explore this morning. And then there are additional problems when you're dealing with assisted procreation, particularly when the problem is with regard to female infertility and you have managed to stimulate ovaries so that they produce ova. Normally, a woman produces one ripe ovum per month, and that's one of the miracles of the Teva, of nature. Each one of the ovaries produces one every second month, and in the normal course of events, conception takes place in the fallopian tube because the sperm meets this ovum. When you are causing superovulation because you're not getting ova naturally, the hormones produce more than one ovum, which is both good and bad. Good because you have a better chance of pregnancy, and the downside is that if you fertilize them in a petri dish in the laboratory, you very often get multiple ova, and you want to reinsert as many as you can in order to ensure or to get a better probability of pregnancy. The success rate per insemination is not terribly high. And obviously, the more fertilized ova you insert into the uterus, the greater will be the chance of carrying to term. That results in problems of multiple pregnancies. More than one may become implanted in the uterine wall, and then you have the issue of fetal reduction, which is another shyla that I don't think we're going to talk about today. Now the practice in this country is not to insert more than three at a time, and triplets is within the bounds of safety for the mother in general circumstances. So we have, you know, all of these serious problems with regard to superovulation, and again now, which is becoming more prevalent, even subject to a number of Piskei Din in Eretz Yisrael, the laboratory has surplus fertilized ova. after the woman has been impregnated successfully. And the question is, what do you do with these fertilized eggs? Well, if the woman is not fertilized successfully or she wants more children, you can freeze them and use them sometime in the future. You can donate them to infertile couples. That presents shyness in and of itself. Or you can use them for medical experimentation, which involves destroying the ovum, and you now have a question of harigas uberim. Those are serious questions. But what has become the modern question is when the couple do not continue to have shalom bayis, marital peace does not reign in the domestic abode, and the couple are now divorced. One of the parties would like to donate it to an infertile couple or destroy them, and the other, usually the wife, wants to become pregnant even though she now has no husband. Who has the right to the fertilized ova?
Who is the owner? Who is the owner of this ovum?
Precisely.
Right. It's the zera of the ish. It's the egg of the female. Together they created a fertilized ova. Who is the owner of it?
Precisely.
Is there any halachic precedent for this?
Yes, there is. There are at least two piskei din. Well, I should say one with a clear piskei din, and the other seems to have been the psak of Rav Shaul Yisraeli. I don't think we want to discuss that in halacha. There is a series of American court decisions adopting different approaches with regard to proprietorship of these fertilized ova. And just in a nutshell, I believe that you have to treat the fertilized ovum as a potential human being, and hence we're really dealing with a foundling issue.
Rabbi Black, can I interrupt you? Because now you have a fertilized ovum and it's in a freezer, right?
Correct.
Now it's Shabbos, and the freezer electricity goes out.
Can you do something to preserve?
Can you be mechal Shabbos to preserve? So we know lahalachi, you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos for an uber. Would you allow to be mechal?
You stated that as a conclusion.
But it's not a conclusion, but most paiskim. Look, the Gemara says, but we paskin that way. Most paiskim neman, you know, ma'abrin sakin b'rishus harabim. The Gemara in Krisis on Daftes, I believe, right? Says to be, and most paiskim neman, you can be mechal Shabbos. Ramban says, why? Because toivoy she mechal Shabbos echas, while mechal Shabbos habasi goes on this. Would you be able to do it for an ovum?
We have to distinguish between the case of an Isha Makasha Leled, where the uber is already nekar, and the earlier stages of gestation. The latter case is not a question. The only question is whether intervention will be medically efficacious in our age. The Machlokes Rishonim is regard to the ubro, the muberis, who smells food on Yom Kippur, and we go through a whole procedure, but basically she's allowed to eat on Yom Kippur, which means Chilul Shabbos would be permissible. Is it Chilul Shabbos because...
The mother or the child.
That's a Machlokes Rishonim.
Yeah.
Now, insofar as the frozen ovum is concerned, Rabbi Wasner has a tshuva. He thinks that it's not permissible according to any of the Rishonim for a lot of different reasons, among which is that the chances that this will be a viable fetus are rather remote, etc., etc. That's, you know, kind of a technical question with regard to Chilul Shabbos. It seems to me that, assuming as I must, because it's far from clear that there are any place scheme who maintain that you can kill an uber even toich mem yoim, it seems to me that there may well be an obligation to preserve the uber. And certainly if the Rishonim who maintain that we give the pregnant woman food on Yom Kippur for purposes of preserving the life of the mother are saying that you require intervention, that there's a duty of Hatzolah, rescue, of this unborn uber. And certainly I don't think that in terms of halacha, either one of the parents has bailus, but that is a matter of dispute, even in terms of halacha. So we can leave that for another time. That's extremely complicated. I believe that today you wanted me to talk about transgender issues, sex change operations, which is now the latest series, presents the latest series of problems in terms of halacha. And we're dealing with something which is, in a very general way, related to the sexual issues, because here we're dealing with questions of sexual identity, and it probably has no real impact upon procreation, certainly not after transgender procedures have been undertaken, but it's one of these disorders that it has to be dealt with.
Rabbi Bleich, respectfully, before we go on to this, would you tell us where do you personally come out on these halachas? Who is the owner? Just give us shorthand. What is your position?
My position, and admittedly is not necessarily the position of the Bote Din and Eretz Yisrael, is that the fertilized ovum cannot be destroyed. You may be able to freeze it at Bias Goyal Tzedek, but I don't think that it can be destroyed. And I don't think that either parent has bailus. There is no such thing as bailus with regard to children. Hachzakas Yelodim, custody in halacha, is not a matter of ownership or a right. It's a schus. It's a privilege. It's the right to rear the child. And, of course, there are disputes in every divorce. Each parent wants the child, and halacha deals with it. In effect, it assigns the schus of Hachzakas Yelodim to one or the other of the parents. And basically, in terms of the pay scheme, certainly the later Achronim, it's really the application of a best interest standard. Only halacha has certain presumptions with regard to what is the best interest. A contract, an agreement between the parties with regard to custody, is not enforced in halacha. It's even cited in the Piskei Tshuva and Eben Ezra for the same reason, because it's not the parent's right to dispose of. I can dispose of my right by contract, but I can't dispose of rights or claims of a third party. So basically what we're dealing with is the benefit of the child, what is best for the child. It seems to me, at least, that when you have a surplus ovum and neither one of the parents wants the child or wants to use the fertilized egg for purposes of procreation, that it is a foundling, and that anyone who comes forth and says, I want to raise this child, should have a right to do so. Certainly, if the alternative is thawing the fertilized egg, which means it will be destroyed. So that, in effect, it's like a yosem, and I don't think that either parent can prevent implantation in a third party. But that's, you know, that's arcane. I was saying before the connection was interrupted,
one of the great halachic authorities and experts on fertility, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, it's been a great honor to have you on with us.
Thank you very much.